called a soldier, because that is what he becomes when he joins us. What you all become. A soldier to fight the shadow. And not just the shadow, but anyone who opposes justice or oppresses the weak. When a soldier reaches a certain stage in his skills, he will be called dedicated and wear this. From the bag, he took one of the badges the silversmith had made. A small, gleaming silver sword, perfect with its long hilt and slanting quillons, and slightly curved blade. Taim! Taim walked to the block stiffly, and Rand bent to pin the silver sword to the tall collar of his coat. It seemed to shine even more brightly against the pitch-black wool. Taim's face had as much expression as the stone beneath Rand's boots. Rand handed him the bag, whispering, "Give these to whoever you think is ready. Just be sure they are." Straightening, he hoped there were enough. He really had not expected anywhere near so many men. "Dedicated who advance their skill far enough will be called Ashaman, and they will wear this." Taking out the small velvet bag, he held up what it contained. Sunlight sparkled on finely crafted gold and rich red enamel, a sinuous form exactly like the one in the dragon banner. That went onto Taim's collar, too, on the other side. So sword and dragon shone at the sides of his throat. "I suppose I was the first, Ashaman," Rand told the students. "But Mazrim Taim is the second." Taim's face made stone look soft. What was wrong with the man? "I hope that all of you will become Ashaman eventually. But whether you do or not, remember that all of us are soldiers. There are many battles ahead. Maybe not always the ones we expect. And at the end, the last battle. The light sended is the last. If the light shines in us, we will win. We will win because we must win." There should have been some sort of cheer when he stopped. He did not take himself for the sort of speaker who could make men jump and shout, but these men knew why they were here. Telling them they would win should have produced something, however feeble. There was only silence. Rand jumped down from the stone block, and Taim snapped, "Disperse to lessons and chores!" The students, the soldiers, went their ways almost as silently as they had stood, with only a murmur of quiet words. Taim motioned toward the farmhouse. He was holding the bag of sword pins so tightly it was a wonder none of them stabbed him through the cloth. "If my lord dragon has time for a cup of wine..." Rand nodded. He wanted to get to the bottom of this before returning to the palace. The front room of the farmhouse was just what might be expected. A bare floor swept spotless, mismatched ladder-backed chairs arranged in front of a red brick fireplace, so clean it seemed impossible it had ever held a fire. A white cloth edged with embroidered flowers covered a small table. Sora Grady entered silently and set a wooden tray atop the cloth with a bright blue pitcher of wine and two white glazed mugs. Rand had thought her gaze would not hurt after all this time, but the accusation in her eyes made him glad when she left. She had been sweating, he realized. Taim tossed the bag onto the tray and emptied a mug straight away. "Don't you teach the women that trick of concentrating?" Rand asked. "It's cruel to make them sweat when their men don't."
"Most want no part of it," Taim said curtly. "Their husbands and sweethearts try to teach them, but most refuse even to listen. It might have to do with Saideen, you see."
Rand peered into his mug at the dark wine. He had to feel his way here. No blowing up just because irritation prickled.
"I'm pleased to see the recruiting going so well. You said you'd match the tower, the White Tower."
White Tower, Black Tower. What would the stories make of that, if there were any?
"In less than a year. And if you keep on at this rate, you will. I don't see how you find so many."
"Sift enough sand," Taim said stiffly, "and you will find a few grains of gold eventually. I leave that to others now, except for a trip or two. Damer, Grady,
There are a dozen men I can trust alone for a day. They have enough years not to do anything stupid. And there are enough younger men with the strength to make a gateway, if not much more, to accompany the older who don't. You will have your 1,000 before the year. What of those I send on to Camelin? Have you made an army of them yet? You have your 1,000 there, and time's over.
I leave that to Bashir, Rand said quietly.
Taim's mouth quirked derisively, and Rand set his mug down before it could break in his grip. Bashir was making what he could of them, he understood, in a camp somewhere west of the city. What he could, considering that they were, as the Saldaean put it, a ragtag collection of penniless farmers, runaway apprentices, and failed craftsmen, who had never held a sword, ridden a horse with a saddle, or been more than 5 miles from where they were born. Rand had too much to concern him to worry about the likes of that. He had told Bashir to do what he wanted with them, and not bother him unless they ran riot. Looking at Taim, who was making no effort to hide his disdain, he stuck his hands behind his back, where they clenched into fists. Luz Theron rumbled in the distance, an echo of his anger. "What has gotten into you? You've had a burr in your britches ever since I put those badges on you. Is it something to do with them? If so, I don't understand. Those men will think more of theirs for seeing you receive yours from the Dragon Reborn. For that matter, they'll think more of you for it. Maybe you won't have to keep discipline by clubbing men over the head. Well, what have you to say?" That began well enough, in a calm tone, if not exactly mild. He had not intended it to be mild. But along the way, his voice grew firmer and louder. Not to a shout, yet that final question cracked like a whip. The most remarkable transformation came over the other man. Taim shook visibly. With rage, Rand would have said, not fear. But when the shaking stopped, he was his old self again. Not friendly, certainly. A touch mocking, but very much relaxed and in control of himself.
"Since you must know, what worries me are Aes Sedai and you. 9 Aes Sedai came to Camelin, plus 2 make 11.
Then there might just be 1 or 2 more. I haven't been able to find them yet, but..."
"I told you to stay out of the city," Rand said flatly.
"I found a few men to ask questions for me." Taim's tone was dry as dust. "I've been no closer than here since I saved you from that gray man." Rand let that pass. Barely. Almost. The voice in his head was too low to be understood, but cold thunder for that.
"They'll catch smoke with their fingers before they catch rumors."
That came out with all the contempt he felt. Taim had saved him? And the man jerked. Outwardly, he still appeared at ease, yet his eyes could have been dark gemstones.
"And if they join with the Red Aes Sedai?"
His voice was cool and amused, but his eyes glittered.
"There are Red Sisters in the countryside. Several parties of them. Arrived in the last few days. Trying to intercept men coming here."
"I will kill him," Luz Theron shouted, and Rand felt that fumbling reach towards Sidene. "Go away," he said firmly.
The fumbling continued, and so did the voice.
"I will kill him, and then them. They must serve him. It is plain. They must serve him."
"Go away," Rand shouted back silently. "You are nothing but a voice." Stretching toward the source.
"O light, I killed them all. All that I loved. If I kill him, it will be well enough, though. I can make it up if I kill him finally. No, nothing can make it up. But I must kill him anyway. Kill them all. I must.
"No," Rand screamed inside his head. "You're dead, Luz Theron. I am alive, Bernew, and you are dead. You are dead."
Abruptly, he realized he was leaning on the table, holding himself up with sagging knees, and muttering, "You are dead. I am alive, and you are dead." But he had not seized Sidene. And neither had Luz Theron.
Shivering, he looked at Taim and was surprised to see concern on the man's face.
"You must hold on," Taim said softly. "If sanity can be held, you must. The price is too high if you fail."
"I won't fail,"
Rand said, pushing himself upright. Luce Theron was silent. There seemed to be nothing in his head but himself, and the feel of Alana, of course.
"Have these Reds taken anyone?"
"Not that I have heard."
Taim was watching him cautiously, as if he expected another outburst.
"Most of the students come through gateways now, and with all the people on the roads, it cannot be easy to pick out a man heading here unless he talks too freely."
He paused.
"They could be disposed of easily enough, in any case."
"No!"
Was Luce Theron really gone? He wished it, and knew he would be a fool to believe.
"If they start taking men, I'll have to do something, but as it is, they're no threat out in the country.
And believe me, nobody Elida sends is likely to join those Aes Sedai in the city. Either lot would probably welcome you before they did each other." "What about those who are not in the countryside?"
11 of them?"
"A few accidents could reduce that to a much safer number. If you don't want to soil your own hands, I am willing to—"
"No! How many times do I have to say no? If I feel a man channeling Camelin, I will come for you, Taim. I swear I will. And don't think you can stay far enough from the palace that I won't feel it and be safe. If one of those Aes Sedai keels over dead for no reason, I will know who to blame. Mark me."
"You set wide boundaries," Taim said dryly. "If Samael or Dimandred decides to taunt you with a few dead Aes Sedai on your doorstep, my veins are opened?"
"They haven't so far, and you had better hope they do not start. Mark me, I say."
"I hear my lord dragon and obey, of course."
The hawk-nosed man bowed slightly.
"But I still say 11 is a dangerous number."
Rand laughed in spite of himself.
"Taim, I intend to teach them to dance to my flute."
Light, how long since he had played the flute? Where was his flute? Faintly, he heard Luce Theron chuckling.
Chapter 43. The Crown of Roses. Marana's hired coach swayed its slow way through the densely packed streets toward the Crown of Roses. Outwardly, she was calm, at least, a dark-haired woman with cool hazel eyes, slim-fingered hands folded peacefully on her pale gray silk skirts. Inside, she was not so serene. 38 years ago, she had been in place by chance to negotiate a treaty between Arad-Doman and Tarabon that was supposed to put an end to the squabbling over Almuth Plain, with Domani and Taraboners dodging at every turn, and three times nearly starting a war in the middle of the exchanges, and all the while maintaining smiling faces of utter goodwill. By the time the signatures were dry, she felt as if she had been rolled over rough hills in a barrel full of splinters, and after all that, the treaty turned out to be worth considerably less than the wax and ribbons for its seals. She hoped what she had begun this afternoon at the royal palace ended better. It had to. But inside, she felt as though she had just climbed out of another barrel. Min was sitting back with her eyes closed. The young woman seemed to take catnaps any time an Aes Sedai was not actually speaking to her. The other two sisters in the coach occasionally shot quick glances at the girl. Cyanid, cool and reserved in her brocaded green. Masuri, slim and merry-eyed in brown, embroidered with flowering vines around the hem. They had all dressed formally, in shawls and Aja colors. Marana was sure they had the same thought as herself when they looked at Min. Cyanid could certainly understand, though who could be certain? Cyanid was very methodical and practical about her warders, almost like a woman with a pair of prize wolfhounds she felt some affection for. Masura might understand. She did like to dance, and even flirt, though she was liable to forget the poor man when she heard a rumor of an old manuscript hidden away. Marana herself had not been in love since well before that fifth treaty of Falma, but she did remember, and all it had taken was one glimpse of Min staring at Al-Thor to see a woman who had tossed sense out the window and was riding her heart at a gallop. Not proof that Min had ignored all their cautions, broken her promise, and told Al-Thor everything, but he knew about Saladar. He knew Elaine was there, and had been amused at their evasions. Aside from whether Min had broken confidence, care would have to be used in what was said around her from now on in any case. It was frightening when taken with everything else. Marana was not used to being frightened. She had been, often, in the year after Basun died. She had never bonded another warder, at least partly because she did not want to go through that again. And also partly because she was simply too busy to search out the right man. But that was the last time she had known anything more than apprehension before the Aiel War. Now she felt fear, and she did not like it. Everything could still go well. Nothing truly disastrous had happened, but Al-Thor himself turned her knees to water. The hired coach rocked to a stop in the stable yard of the Crown of Roses. Stablemen in vests worked with roses, rushing out to take bridles and open doors. The common room suited the three stories of finely dressed white stone, all dark, polished panels, with tall fireplaces faced in white marble. One mantelpiece held a wide clock, with chimes for the hours and a few lines of gilding. The serving women wore blue dresses and white aprons embroidered with a ring of roses. They were all smiling, polite, efficient, and those not pretty were handsome. The Crown of Roses was a favorite of nobles in from the country who had no mansions of their own in Camelin, but now the tables held only warders, and Alana and Varin seated at the rear. Had Marana had her wishes, they would have been waiting in the kitchens with the servants. The rest of the sisters were all out. There was no time to waste. "If you don't mind," Min said, "I would like to walk around. I'd like to see some of Camelin before dark." Marana gave her assent, and as the young woman darted back outside, exchanged looks with Cianid and Masuri, wondering how long it would take Min to return to the palace. Mistress Sinchonin appeared at once, as round as any innkeeper Marana had ever seen, bobbing bows and dry-washing her pink hands. "Is there anything I can do for you, Aes Sedai? Anything I can fetch?" She had accommodated Marana often, and well, both before and after learning she was Aes Sedai. "Berry tea," Marana told her, smiling, "in the private sitting room upstairs." The smile went as the innkeeper scurried away, calling for one of the serving women. Marana motioned sharply for Alana and Varin to join her on the stairs, and the five of them climbed in silence. The sitting room windows gave a good view of the street for those who wished it, which Marana did not particularly. She pulled in the windows that were open to shut out some of the noise, and turned her back on them. Cianid and Masuri had taken chairs. Alana and Varin remained standing between the other two. Varin's dark wool dress had an air of being rumpled, though it was not, and she had an ink stain on the tip of her nose, but her eyes were bird-like, sharp and watchful. Alana's eyes shone, too, but very likely with anger, and now and then her hands quivered slightly, gripping the skirts of her yellow bodiced blue silk dress. It looked as if she had slept in it. There was some excuse for her, of course. Some, but not enough. "I do not know yet, Alana," Marana said firmly, "whether your actions have had any adverse effect. He did not bring up your bonding him against his will, but he was sharp. Very sharp, and—" "Has he set further restrictions?" Varin broke in, tilting her head slightly. "All seems to be going well, to me. He did not fly away at news of you. He has received 3, in some courtesy, at least, or you would be at Sunderheads. He is a little frightened of us, which is to the good, or he would not have set limits, but unless he has set more— We still have as much freedom as before, so he is not terrified. Above all, we must not frighten him too far." The difficulty was that Varin and Alana were not part of Marana's delegation. She had no authority over them. They had heard the news of Loghain and the Reds and agreed that Elida could not be allowed to remain in the Ammerlin seat, yet that meant nothing. Of course, Alana was not really a problem, only potentially. She and Marana were so close in strength that the only way to say which had the greater would be an actual contest, the sort of thing novices did until they were caught. Alana had been 6 years a novice, Marana only 5, but more importantly, Marana had been Aes Sedai 10 years the day the midwife laid Alana at her mother's breast. That took care of that. Marana had precedence. No one actually thought in those terms unless something made them, but they both knew and adjusted automatically. Not that Alana would take orders, yet instinctive deference would surely keep her in hand to some degree. That, and knowing what she had done. Varen was the problem, the one who had Marana thinking of strengths and precedence. Marana let herself sense the other woman's strength in the power again, though of course she knew what she would find. No way to tell which of them was stronger. 5 years as novice for each, 6 as accepted. That was one thing every Aes Sedai knew about every other if she knew nothing else. The difference was that Varen was older, maybe almost as much older than she as she was older than Alana. The touch of gray in Varen's hair emphasized it. Had Varen been part of the embassy, there would have been no difficulty at all, but she was not, and Marana found herself listening attentively, deferring without thinking. Twice in the morning she'd had to remind herself that Varen was not in charge. The only thing that made the situation tolerable was that Varen must feel she shared some of Alana's guilt. Without that, she surely would have been in a chair as soon as anyone else, not standing beside Alana. If only there were some way to make her remain at Culain's Hound day and night to watch over that wonderful treasure of girls from the Two Rivers. Seating herself so she, Sionid, and Masuri surrounded the pair, Marana adjusted her skirts and shawl carefully. There was some moral ascendancy in being seated while the others remained standing. To her, what Alana had done was little short of rape. In fact, he has placed another restriction. It is all very well that you two have located his school, but now I strongly suggest you abandon whatever thoughts you may have had in that direction. He has charged us to stay away from his men. She could see him still, leaning forward in that monstrosity of a throne with the lion throne on exhibit behind him and a carved piece of spear in his fist. No doubt an Aiel custom, that. "Hear me, Marana Sedai," he said, quite pleasantly and quite firmly. "I want no trouble between Aes Sedai and Ashaman. I have told the soldiers to stay clear of you, but I do not mean them to be Aes Sedai meat. If you go hunting at the Black Tower, you may be dinner yourself. We both want to avoid that." Marana had been Aes Sedai long enough not to shiver every time a goose walked over her grave, but it was close this time. Ashaman. The Black Tower. Mazrim Time. How could it have gone so far? Yet Alana was certain there were over 100 men, though she gave no details of how she knew, of course. No sister willingly exposed her eyes and ears. It did not matter. "If you pursue 2 hares, both will escape you," the old saying went, and Althor was the most important hare in the world. The others had to wait. Is he still here, or has he gone? Varen and Alana seemed to take it very calmly that Althor apparently could travel. It still made Marana a trifle queasy. What else had he taught himself that Aes Sedai had forgotten? Alana? Alana! The slender green sister jerked, pulling herself back from wherever her mind had been. She seemed to drift quite often. "He is in the city. In the palace, I think." She still sounded a little dreamy. He has a wound in his side. An old wound, yet only half healed. Every time I let myself dwell on it, I want to weep. How can he live with it?" Sionid gave her a sharp look. Any woman who had a warder had felt his injuries. But she knew what Alana was going through, having lost Owen, and when she spoke, her voice was almost gentle and only a little brisk. "Why, Terrell and Furin have taken wounds that almost made me faint, even feeling them as softly as we do, and they never slowed a step, not one step." "I think," Missouri said quietly, "we are going afield." She always spoke quietly, but unlike many Browns, always to the point. Mirana nodded. "Yes, I considered taking Moiraine's place with him." A rap at the door announced a white-aproned woman with the tea tray, a silver teapot and porcelain cups. The Crown and Rose was used to the nobility. By the time the tray was settled and the serving woman gone, Alana was no longer dreamy. Her dark eyes flashed with all the fire Mirana had ever seen in them. Greens, particularly, were jealous of their warders, and Althor belonged to her now, however she had bonded him. Deference went down the well when it came to that. Straight as a blade she stood, just waiting for Mirana's next words to see whether to slash and cut. Still, Mirana waited until the blueberry tea was poured and everyone back in her chair. She even told Varin and Alana to sit. The fool woman deserved a little upset, even atop Owen. Maybe it was not short of rape at all. "I considered it," she went on at last, "and rejected it. I might have done so if you had not done what you did, Alana, but he is so suspicious of Aes Sedai now that he might well laugh in my face if I suggested it." "He is as arrogant as any king," Cyanid said curtly. "Everything Elaine and Nynaeve said, and more," Missouri added, shaking her head, "claiming that he knows when a woman channels. I almost embraced Sidar to show him he was mistaken, but of course whatever I did to show him might have alarmed him too much. All those Aiel." Cyanid's voice was tight. She was Kyrianan. "Men and women. I think they would have tried to spear us if we blinked too quickly. One, a sun-haired woman who was at least wearing skirts, made no effort at all to hide her dislike." At times, Mirana thought, Cyanid did not fully realize that Althor himself might be a danger. Alana unconsciously began chewing her underlip like a girl. It was good she had Varin to take care of her. She was not fit to be out alone in her state. Varin merely sipped her tea and watched. Varin's eyes could be most disconcerting. Mirana found herself relenting. She remembered too well the fragile bundle of nerves she had been after Baron. "Fortunately, it seems there may be a good side to his suspicion. He has received emissaries from Elida in Kyrian. He was quite open about it. Suspicion will make him keep them at a long arm's length, I believe." Cyanid rested her cup in its saucer. "He thinks to play us one against the other." "And he might still," Missouri said dryly, "except that we know more of him than Elida possibly can. I think she must have sent her envoys to meet a shepherd, if a shepherd in a silk coat. Whatever he is, he is no longer that. Moiraine taught him well, it seems." "We were forearmed," Mirana said. "I think it unlikely they were." Alana stared at them, blinking. "Then I have not ruined everything?" They all three nodded, and she took a deep breath, then smoothed at her skirts with a frown, as if just noticing the wrinkles. "I may yet be able to make him accept me." The wrinkles were abandoned, and her face and voice became calmer and more confident by the word. "As for his amnesty, we may have to hold any plans in abeyance, but that doesn't mean we should not make them. That sort of danger cannot be ignored." For a moment, Mirana regretted her relenting. The woman had done that to a man, and all that truly worried her was whether it damaged their chance of success. Reluctantly, though, she admitted that had it made Althor biddable, she would have held her nose and her tongue. "First, we must bring Althor to heel, so to speak. The abeyance will last as long as it must, Alana." Alana's mouth tightened, but after a moment she nodded in acquiescence, or at least assent. "And how is he to be brought to heel?" Varin asked. "He must be handled delicately. a wolf on a leash one thread thick. Marana hesitated. She had not meant to share everything with this pair, who had only the most tenuous allegiance to the hall in Salidar. She dreaded what would happen if Varen tried to take over here, if in fact she did manage to take over. She herself knew how to handle this. She had been chosen because of a lifetime spent mediating sensitive disputes, negotiating treaties where the hatred seemed implacable. That agreements were broken eventually and treaties violated was the nature of humanity. Yet in 46 years, the Fifth Treaty of Falma was her only real failure. She knew all of that, but all of those years had ingrained some instincts deeply. We are approaching certain nobles, who by good luck are all in Camelin now. My worry is Elaine, Dailan said firmly, the more firmly for being alone in the sitting room with an Aes Sedai. Aes Sedai could press hard if you weakened when you were alone, especially when no one else knew you were alone with her. Karen Sedai smiled, but neither smile nor cool blue eyes gave away anything. It is quite possible the daughter heir will yet be found to sit on the line throne. What may seem insurmountable to others is seldom so to Aes Sedai. The dragon reborn says, men say many things, Lady Dailan, but you know I do not lie.
Luan patted the Tyran stallion's gray neck, looking both ways in case one of the grooms came into the stables, and barely dodged a bite from wicked teeth. Rafella's warder would give warning, but Luan was not sure he trusted anyone of late. Especially not with a visit of this sort.
I am not sure I understand, he said curtly.
Unity is better than division, Rafella said. Peace better than war. Patience better than death.
Luan's head jerked at the odd end to the platitudes, and the round-faced Aes Sedai smiled.
Will Andor not be better off if Randalthor leaves the land in peace and unity, Lord Luan?
Holding her robe shut, Elorian stared at the Aes Sedai who had managed to reach her in her bath without being announced, possibly without being seen. The coppery-skinned woman looked back from the stool on the other side of the marble tub full of water as though this were all natural and ordinary. Who, Elorian asked finally, would have the lion throne then, Dimira Sedai? The wheel weaves as the wheel wills, was the reply. And Elorian knew she would get no other.
Chapter 44 The Color of Trust. Once Vannin had gone to tell the band to sit tight, Matt found that not an inn remained in Salidar, but was taken over by Aes Sedai, and the five stables were all full to bursting. Yet when he slipped a little silver to a narrow-jawed stableman, the fellow had the sacks of oats and bales of hay shifted from a stone-walled yard that was fine for 6 horses. He also showed Matt and the remaining 4 men of the band places to sleep in the loft, which was little cooler than anywhere else. "Ask for nothing," Matt told his men as he divided the rest of his coins among them. "Pay for everything and accept no gifts. The band isn't going to be beholden to anybody here." His false air of confidence communicated itself to them, and they did not even hesitate when he ordered them to fix the banners out the loft door, so they hung down in front of the stable, crimson and white, the black and white disc, and the dragon, plain to everybody. On the other hand, the stableman's eyes bulged, and they almost danced as they demanded to know what Matt was doing. He only grinned and tossed the narrow-jawed fellow a gold mark. "Just letting everybody know for sure who's come to call." He wanted Egwene to realize he was not going to be pushed around, and sometimes making people see that meant you had to act like Jack Fool. The trouble was, the banners had no effect. Oh, everybody who walked by gaped and pointed. A number of Aes Sedai came just to look, cool-eyed and expressionless. But he more than half expected an indignant demand to take them down, and that never materialized. When he returned to the little tower, an Aes Sedai who somehow managed to be prune-faced despite smooth, ageless cheeks
shifted her brown-fringed shawl, and told him in no uncertain terms that the Amelin seat was busy. Perhaps she could see him in a day or two. Perhaps. Elaine appeared to have vanished, and so did Avienda. But no one was crying murder yet. He suspected the Aiel might be somewhere having a white dress pulled over her head. All the same to him, if it kept the peace. He did not want to be the one to tell Rand one had killed the other. He did catch a sight of Nynaeve, but she ducked around a corner and was gone by the time he reached it. He spent most of the afternoon looking for Tom and Julin. Either one surely could tell him more of what was going on, and besides, he needed to apologize to Tom for his remarks about that letter. Unfortunately, nobody seemed to know where they were either. Long before nightfall, he concluded that they were being kept out of his way. Egwene really did mean for him to stew, but he intended to let her know he was not even simmering. In aid of that, he went dancing. It seemed that celebrations over a new Amelin were supposed to go on for a month, and though everyone in Saladhar seemed to be working at a run during the day, once darkness fell, bonfires were lit at every street crossing, and fiddles and flutes appeared, and even a dulcimer or two. Music and laughter filled the air, and festival reigned until bedtime. He saw Aes Sedai dancing in the streets, with carters and stablemen still in their rough clothes, and warders dancing with serving women, and cooks who had put aside their aprons. No Egwene, though. The Amelin bloody seat was not going to caper in the streets. No Elaine or Nynaeve, either. And no Tom or Julin. Tom would not have missed a dance with both legs broken, unless he was deliberately kept away. Matt settled down to enjoy himself, to let everybody see he had not a care in the world. It did not work exactly as he wished. He danced a short time with the most beautiful woman he had ever seen in his life, a slim yet buxom armful who wanted to know all about Matt Cawthon. Very flattering, especially when she had asked him to step out. But after a while he noticed that Halima had a way of brushing against him, a way of leaning to look at something, so he could not help seeing down her dress. He might have enjoyed it, if not for the fact that she glanced at his face every time with a sharp eye and an amused smile. She was not a very good dancer. She kept trying to lead, for one thing. And he finally begged off. It should have been nothing, but before he had gone 10 paces, the fox head went icy cold on his chest. He spun around, looking furiously for anything at all. What he saw was Halima staring at him in the firelight. Only for an instant before she seized a tall warder's arm and whirled back into the dance, but he was sure he had seen shock on that beautiful face. The fiddles were wailing a tune he recognized. At least, one of his old memories did. Not very much changed, considering the passage of well over 1,000 years. The words must have changed altogether, for the old words that echoed in his head would never have found favor here. "Give me your trust," said the Aes Sedai. "On my shoulders I support the sky. Trust me to know and to do what is best, and I will take care of the rest. But trust is the color of a dark seed growing. Trust is the color of a heart's blood flowing. Trust is the color of a soul's last breath. Trust is the color of death."
"Aes Sedai?"
a plump young woman said contemptuously to his question. She was pretty, and he might have tried for a bit of a kiss and cuddle in different circumstances.
"Halima's just Delana Sedai's secretary. Always teasing the men, she is, like a child with a new toy. Teasing just to see if she can. She'd be in hot water to her neck 10 times over if Delana didn't protect her."
"Give me your trust," said the queen on her throne, "for I must bear the burden all alone. Trust me to lead and to judge and to rule, and no man will think you a fool. But trust is the sound of the grave dog's bark. Trust is the sound of betrayal in the dark. Trust is the sound of a soul's last breath. Trust is the sound of death." Maybe he had been mistaken. Maybe she had just been shocked that he walked off. Not many men would walk away from a woman who looked like that, no matter how she teased or danced. That had to be it. But that left the question of who and why.
He looked around at the dancers and the people watching from the edge of the shadows and waiting their turns. The golden-haired hunter for the horn, who seemed familiar when spinning by with a particularly lumpy-faced fellow, her braid almost standing out behind her. Matt could pick out Aes Sedai by their faces. Most of them he could, but there was no way to tell which had tried to... whatever it was she had tried. He strode on down the street to the next bonfire, as much to get away from that song as anything. But it went on through the King on High and the Lady and Lord to the love of your life in his head. In that old memory, he remembered writing that song because of the love of his life. Trust is the taste of death. At that next corner, a fiddler and a woman with a flute were playing what sounded like Fluff the Feathers, a good country dance. How far could he trust Egwene? She was Aes Sedai now. She must be if she was Ammerlin, even a ragtag Ammerlin in a ragtag village. Well, whatever she was Egwene. He could not believe she would strike at him out of the dark that way. Of course Nynaeve might, though not to injure him, really. His hip still hurt, though. The bruise had made a knot. And the Light only knew what a woman like Elaine might do. They were still trying to chase him away, he decided. He could probably expect more attempts. The best thing was to ignore them. He almost hoped they did try again. They could not touch him with the power, and the more they tried and failed, why, the more they would have to see he was not to be budged. Morella came to stand beside him, watching the dancers. He remembered her vaguely. He did not think she knew anything dangerous about him. He did not think so. She was not as beautiful as Halima, of course, but still much more than merely pretty. Flickering shadows washed her face, so he could almost forget she was Aes Sedai. "A warm night," she said, smiling, and went on in such a casual way while he enjoyed looking at her that it took him some time to realize what she was getting at. "I don't think so," he said politely when she gave an opening. This was what came of forgetting. Aes Sedai were Aes Sedai. She only smiled. "There would be many advantages, and I would not try to pin you to my skirts. Many advantages. You've chosen a perilous life, or had it chosen for you. A warder might have a better chance of survival." "I really don't think so." "No, but thank you for the offer." "Think on it, Matt. Unless... has the Ammerlin bonded you?" "No. Egwene would not do that. Would she?" "She could not, so long as he wore the medallion. But would she if he did not have it?" "If you will excuse me." He gave her a shallow bow and walked quickly to where a pretty blue-eyed young woman was tapping her foot to the music. She had a sweet mouth, just right for kissing, and he bloody well wanted to enjoy himself. "I saw your eyes, and I couldn't help coming over. Will you dance?" Two ladies saw the great serpent ring on her right hand, and then that sweet mouth opened, and a voice he recognized said dryly, "I asked you once whether you'd be there when the house was burning down, boy, but it seems you make a habit of jumping into fires. Now go away and find somebody who wants to dance with you."
Swan Sanjay.
She was stilled and dead. She was glaring at him with some young woman's face she had stolen, was what she was, and wearing an Aes Sedai ring. He had asked Swan Sanjay to dance. While he was still staring, a willowy young Domani woman swirled up in a pale green dress, thin enough for the light of the bonfire to silhouette her through it. Giving Swan a frosty look that was returned with interest, the Domani all but snatched him out among the dancers. She was as tall as an Aiel woman, dark eyes actually a little higher than his.
"I am Leanna, by the way," she said in a voice like a honeyed caress, "in case you did not recognize me."
Her low laugh was almost a caress, too. He jumped and nearly fumbled the first turn. She also wore the ring. He moved by rote. Tall or not, she was a feather in his hands, a gliding swan. But that was certainly not enough to stop the question that kept popping in his head like an illuminator's fireworks.
How? How under the light? To top it all, when the dance was done, she said, "You are a very good dancer," in that stroking voice, and then kissed him about as thoroughly as he had ever been kissed. He was so shocked he did not even try to get away. Sighing, she patted his cheek. "A very good dancer. Think of it as dancing next time, and you will do better." And off she went laughing, back into the dance with some fellow she snagged from the onlookers. Matt decided he had had as much as one man could take in a night. He went back to the stable and went to sleep with his saddle for a pillow. His dreams would have been pleasant, except that they all involved Mirella and Swan and Liana and Halima. When it came to dreams, a man just naturally lacked the sense to pour water out of a boot. The next day had to be better, he thought, especially when Dawn found Vannon in the loft to sleep on his saddle. Talmanis understood and would hold where he was. Warders had been seen watching the band's preparations, no doubt letting themselves be seen, but no one had come near the band. A less pleasant surprise was finding Alvar's gray in the yard behind the stable, and Alvar himself curled up in his blankets in a corner. "You need somebody to watch your back," he told Matt darkly. "She cannot be trusted." There was no need for him to name Avienda. Alvar had no interest in playing with the children in the village, so Matt had to endure the stares and smiles as the boy trailed him around Saladar, doing his best to imitate a warder's flowing stride and looking nine ways at once for Avienda, who was still nowhere to be seen any more than Elaine or Nynaeve. And the Ammerlin was still busy. Tom and Julin were also busy. Vannon managed to hear a few things, but nothing that made Matt happy. If Nynaeve had really healed Swan and Liana, she would be worse than ever. She had always had a large opinion of herself, and after doing what could not be done, her head would be bigger than a dew melon. Yet that was the mildest of it. Loghain and the Red Aja made Matt wince. That sounded the sort of thing no Aes Sedai would forgive. If Garth Bryn was leading their army, it was no mob of farmers and street sweepings, with a few warders for stiffening. Add in the foodstuffs Vannon saw being wrapped or stuck in barrels for travel, and it sounded like trouble. The worst kind of trouble Matt could imagine, short of finding one of the Forsaken across the table from him, and a dozen Trollocs coming in the door. None of it made them any less fools. It made them very dangerous fools. Tom and his "help them make it work." If the Gleeman ever came out of hiding, maybe he could pull a "how" out of one of his tails. In the evening, Mirella spoke to him again about becoming a warder, and went a little tight around the eyes when he told her hers would be the fifth offer he had refused since sunup. He was not sure she believed him. She flounced off in as much of a huff as he had ever seen from an Aes Sedai. It was true, though. The very first, while he was still trying to eat breakfast, had been the very Delana that Halima worked for, a stout, pale-haired woman with watery blue eyes who came close to trying to bully him into it. That night he stayed away from the dancing and went to sleep with music and laughter in his ears. They sounded sour this time. It was mid-afternoon of his second full day in Saladar, when a girl in a white dress, pretty and freckled and working very hard at an icy dignity that she almost reached, found him with a summons, and it was exactly that. "You will present yourself before the Ammerlin seat at once." Full stop, and not another word. Matt motioned to her to lead. It seemed proper, and she seemed to like doing it. They were all there in that room in the little tower, Egwene and Nynaeve, Elaine and Avienda, though he had to look twice to recognize the Aiel woman in a blue dress of fine wool with a lace collar and cuffs. At least neither Avienda nor Elaine was trying to strangle the other, but they were both stony-faced, which made them no different from Egwene and Nynaeve. Not a flicker of expression in the four, and all eyes on him. He managed to hold his tongue while Egwene laid out his choices as she saw them, sitting behind the table with that striped stole draped on her shoulders. "Should you think you can do neither," she finished, "remember that I can have you tied to your horse and returned to your band of the hand. There is no room in Celadar for slackers and malingerers. I will not allow it. For you, Matt, it's either Ebudar, with Elaine and Nynaeve, or off to see who you can impress with flags and banners."
Which really left no choice at all, of course. When he said so, nobody's expression changed. If anything, Nynaeve grew more wooden. And Egwene just said,
"I'm glad that is done, Matt. Now I have 1,000 things to do. I will try to see you before you go."
Dismissed like a stable boy, the Ammerlin was busy. The least she could have done was toss him a copper. That was why Matt's third morning in Saladar found him just outside it, on the cleared ground, between village and forest. "They may stay right here till I get back," he told Talmanis, glancing over his shoulder toward the houses. They would be coming soon, and he did not want any of this getting back to Egwene. She would try to drive a spike through it if she could.
"I hope so, anyway. If they move, follow wherever they go, but never close enough to frighten. And if a young woman named Egwene shows up, you ask no questions, just take her and ride to Camelin if you have to cut a hole through Garth Bryn."
Of course, they might be intending to go to Camelin. There might be a chance. He was afraid it was Tar-Valon they were aiming at, though. Tar-Valon and the headsman's axe.
"And take Nerim with you."
Talmanis shook his head.
"If you are taking Nalissian, I will be offended if you do not let me send my man to care for your things."
Matt wished Talmanis would smile once in a while. It would help to know when he was serious. He certainly sounded serious. Nerim stood a little distance off with Pips, and his own short, plump brown mare towering over him, and 2 pack horses with wicker panniers stuffed to the top. Nalissian's man, a stout fellow named Lopin, only led 1 pack animal in addition to his hammer-nosed gelding, and Nalissian's tall black stallion. That was not all the party. No one seemed ready to tell him more than where to be and when, but in the middle of yet another talk about becoming a warder, Morella had let him know it was now all right for him to communicate with the band, so long as he did not try to bring them nearer Saladar. That had been the last thing in his mind. Vannin was there this morning because he could probably spy out the lay of the land anywhere, and 12 cavalrymen chosen from the band for heavy shoulders and having kept order well as red arms back in Mehrone. From what Nalissian said, quick fists and cudgels should be able to quell any inconvenience Nynaeve and Elaine got into, at least long enough to spirit them away. Last of all was Alvar. On the gray, he had named Wind, which the leggy animal might even deserve. Alvar had been no hard choice. The band might well find trouble if they actually had to follow that lot of mad women. Maybe not trouble with Bryn, but enough nobles would bristle at 2 armies crossing their lands to provide nightly attempts at the horses and arrows flying from every 2nd thicket. Any city had to be safer than that for a boy. Still no sign of any Aes Sedai, and the sun beginning to bake above the treetops. Matt jerked his hat down irritably. "Nalissian knows Ebudar, Talmanis." The Tyran grinned through his sweat and nodded. Talmanis's face did not change. "Oh, all right. Nerim comes." Talmanis inclined his head. Maybe he had been serious. At last there was a stir in the village. A group of women leading horses. Not just Elaine and Nynaeve, though he had not expected anyone else. Avienda wore a gray riding dress, but she looked at her lean dun mare more than doubtfully. That hunter with the golden braid showed more confidence with a heavy haunched mouse-colored gelding and seemed to be trying to convince Avienda of something about her mare. What was either of them doing here? There were 2 Aes Sedai as well. Other Aes Sedai besides Nynaeve and Elaine, he supposed he should say. Slender women with white hair, which he had not seen on an Aes Sedai before. An old fellow trailed after them with a pack horse in addition to his own mount, a stringy man without much hair, and that gray. It took Matt a moment to realize he was a warder, with one of those color-shifting cloaks hanging down his back.
That was what being a warder meant. Aes Sedai worked you till your hair fell out, then probably worked your bones after you were dead. Tom and Julin came not far behind, and they had a pack horse, too. The women stopped some 50 paces to the left with their aged warder, not so much as looking at Matt and his men. The gleeman glanced at Nynaeve and the others, then spoke to Julin, and they led their horses toward Matt, stopping short, as if uncertain of their welcome. Matt went to them.
"I have to apologize, Matt," Tom said, knuckling his mustaches. "Elaine put it in no uncertain terms that I wasn't to talk with you further. She only relented this morning. In a weak moment some months back, I promised to follow her orders, and she flings it in my face at the most awkward times. She wasn't very pleased that I had said as much as I did."
"Nynaeve threatened to punch my eye if I went near you," Julin said glumly, leaning on his bamboo staff. He was wearing a red terabonner cap that could not give much protection from the sun, and even that looked glum. Matt looked toward the women. Nynaeve was peeking at him over her saddle, but when she saw him looking, she ducked behind her horse, a plump brown mare. He would not have thought even Nynaeve could beat Julin down, but the dark thief-taker was a far cry from the man he had known briefly in Tyr. That Julin had been ready for anything. This Julin, with a permanent furrowed brow, looked as if he never stopped worrying.
"We will teach her some manners this trip, Julin. Tom, I'm the one has to apologize. What I said about the letter. It was the heat talking, and worry over fool women. I hope it was good news."
Too late he remembered what Tom had said. He had left the woman who wrote that letter to die. But Tom only shrugged. Matt did not know what to make of him without his gleeman's cloak.
"Good news? I haven't puzzled that out yet. Often you don't know whether a woman is friend, enemy, or lover until it is too late. Sometimes she is all three."
Matt expected a laugh, but Tom frowned and sighed.
"Women always seem to like making themselves mysterious, Matt. I can give you an example. Do you remember Aludra?"
Matt had to think. "The Illuminator we kept from getting her throat slit in Arengil."
"The very one.
Julin and I met her during our travels, and she didn't know me. Not that she failed to recognize me. You say things to a stranger you travel with to get to know them. Aludra did not want to know me. And even if I didn't know why, I saw no reason to impose. I met her a stranger and left her a stranger. Now, would you call her a friend or an enemy?"
"Maybe a lover," Matt said dryly.
He would not mind meeting Aludra again. She had given him some fireworks that proved very useful.
"If you want to know about women, ask Perrin, not me. I don't know anything at all. I used to think Rand knew, but Perrin surely does."
Elaine was talking with the two white-haired Aes Sedai under the hunter's watchful eye. One of the older Aes Sedai gazed in Matt's direction consideringly. They had the same sort of bearing Elaine did, cool as a queen on her bloody throne.
"Well, with luck, I won't have to put up with them long," he muttered to himself. "With luck, whatever they're doing won't take long, and we can be back here in 5 or 10 days.
With luck, he might be back before the band had to begin shadowing the mad women. Tracking not one army but two would be easy as stealing a pie, of course, but he did not look forward to any more days in Elaine's company than necessary.
10 days, Tom said. "Matt, even with this gateway, it will take 5 or 6 just to reach Ebu Dar. Better than 20 or so, but..."
Matt stopped listening. Every shred of irritation that had been building since he first laid eyes on Egwene again came to a head at once. Snatching off his hat, he stalked to where Elaine and the others were. Keeping him in the dark was bad enough. How was he supposed to keep them out of trouble when they told him nothing? But this was ridiculous. Nynaeve saw him coming and darted behind her mare for some reason.
"It will be interesting traveling with the Ta'veren," one of the white-haired Aes Sedai said.
Up close, he still could not fasten any age to her, yet somehow her face conveyed an impression of long years. It must have been the hair. She could have used the other for a mirror. Maybe they really were sisters.
I am Vandine Namella.
Matt was in no mood to talk about being Taviran. He was never in that mood, but certainly not now.
What's this nonsense I hear about 5 or 6 days to reach Ebu Dar?
The old warder straightened, staring hard, and Matt reevaluated him as well. Stringy but hard as old roots. It made no difference in his tone.
You can open a gateway inside of Ebu Dar. We aren't any bloody army to scare anyone. And as for popping out of air, you're Aes Sedai. People expect you to pop out of air and walk through walls.
I fear you are speaking to the wrong one of us,
Vandine said. He looked at the other white-haired woman, who shook her head as Vandine said,
Nor Adelius, I fear. It appears we are not strong enough for some of the new things.
Matt hesitated, then settled his hat low and turned to Elaine. Her chin came up.
Apparently you know rather less than you believe, Master Cawthon, she said coolly.
She was not sweating, he realized. No more than the other two, Aes Sedai. The hunter was staring at him challengingly. What had put a bee in her ear?
There are villages and farms around Ebu Dar for 100 miles,
Elaine went on, explaining the obvious to a fool.
A gateway is quite dangerous. I do not intend to kill some poor man's sheep or cows, much less the poor man himself.
He hated more than her tone. She was right, and he hated that too. He was not about to admit she was, though, not to her, and searching for a way to retreat, he saw Egwene coming out of the village with 2 dozen or more Aes Sedai, most wearing fringed shawls. Or rather, she came and they followed. Head held high, she looked straight ahead, that striped stole hanging about her neck. The others strolled along behind her in little clumps. Shiriam, wearing the blue keeper's stole, was talking with Mirella and a bluff-faced Aes Sedai who managed to look motherly. Except for Delana, he recognized none of the others. One had gray hair in a bun. How old did Aes Sedai have to be for their hair to go completely gray or white? But they were all talking among themselves, ignoring the woman they had named Amarlin. Egwene might as well have been alone. She looked alone. Knowing her, she was trying very hard to be what they had named her, and they let her walk alone with everybody watching. To the pit of doom with them if they think they can treat a Two Rivers woman that way, he thought grimly. Striding to meet Egwene, he swept off his hat and bowed, making the best leg he knew how, and he could flourish with the best when he had to. "Good morning, Mother, and the light shine on you," he said, loud enough to be heard in the village. Kneeling, he seized her right hand and kissed her great serpent ring. A quick glare and a grimace directed at Talmanis and the others, and hidden by Egwene from those behind her, had them all scrambling to kneel and call out, "The light illumine you, Mother," or some variation. Even Tom and Julin. Egwene looked startled at first, though she hid it quickly. Then she smiled and said softly,
Thank you, Matt.
For a moment he stared up at her, then cleared his throat and stood brushing off his knees. Shiriam and all those others behind Egwene were staring at him. I didn't expect you out here, he said in a low voice, but then it seems there are all sorts of things I didn't expect. Does the Amarlin always see people off on trips? You wouldn't by any chance want to tell me what it's all about now, would you? At first he thought she might. Then her mouth tightened for an instant, and she gave a slight shake of her head.
I will always see friends off, Matt. I'd have spoken with you before this if I was not so busy. Matt, do try to stay out of trouble in Ebu Dar.
He stared indignantly.
Here he went kneeling and kissing rings, and she told him to stay out of trouble, when the whole point was for him to keep Elaine and Nynaeve with whole skins.
I will try, Mother, he said wryly, but not too. Shiriam and some of those might be close enough to hear. If you will excuse me, I must see to my men. Another bow, and he backed away a few steps before stalking over to where Talmanis and the rest were still on their knees.
"Do you mean to stay there till you take root?" he growled. "Mount up!" He followed his own order, and everyone but Talmanis scrambled into their saddles. Egwene passed a few words with Elaine and Nynaeve, while Vandine and Adelais went to speak to Shiryam. And then it was time, as quick as that, after all their dawdling. Matt half expected some sort of ceremony, with Egwene there in the Amaranth stole, but she and the others, who were not going, merely withdrew a little distance. Elaine stepped out, and suddenly there was a slash of light in front of her, widening into a hole. The view through it, what seemed to be a low hilltop covered in brown grass, rotating to a halt. Just like when Rand did it. Almost. "Dismount," Matt ordered. Elaine looked quite pleased with herself. You would never suspect the sort of woman she was from that delighted smile, asking Nynaeve and Avienda to share her pleasure. But pleased or not, the gateway was not as large as the one Rand had made for the band. Of course, there were not nearly so many as the band. But the least she could have done was make it tall enough to ride through. On the other side, low, rolling brown grass hills ran as far as Matt could see, even when he climbed back onto Pips, though a darkness to the south suggested forest. Dusty hills.
"We must not press the horses too hard in this," Adelais said, swinging quite easily onto her round bay mare as soon as the gateway vanished.
The animal looked as if it would be more at home in a barn.
"Oh, indeed not," Vandine said.
Her mount was a slab-sided black gelding that had a light step. The pair of them started south, motioning everyone to follow. The old warder rode right at their heels. Nynaeve and Elaine exchanged irritated looks, then booted their mares to catch the older women, hooves beating up dust until they were level. The yellow-braided hunter dogged them the way the warder did the other pair. Sighing, Matt undid the black kerchief around his neck and retied it over his nose and mouth. Much as he might enjoy seeing the older Aes Sedai teach those two to sit up straight, what he really wanted was an uneventful ride, a short stay in Ebu Dar, and a quick jump back to Saladar before Egwene did anything stupid and irretrievable. Women always gave him trouble. He did not understand it.
When the gateway winked out, Egwene sighed. Maybe Elaine and Nynaeve between them could keep Matt from getting into too much trouble. Keeping him out entirely was probably too much to ask. She felt a pang of regret for using him, but he might be some use where he was, and he had had to be gotten away from the band. Besides, he deserved it. Maybe Elaine would teach him a few manners. Turning to the others, the hall and Shiryam and her circle, she said, "Now we must get on with what we're about." All eyes went to the Kyrianan in the dark coat, just now mounting his horse near the trees. Talmanis, Egwene thought Matt had said his name was. She had not dared ask too many questions. He studied them for a moment and shook his head before riding into the forest. "A man who means trouble if I ever saw one," Romanda said. Lelaine nodded. "It will be well to put miles between ourselves and that sort." Egwene did not let herself smile. Matt's band had served its first purpose, but a great deal depended on exactly what orders Matt had left with this Talmanis. She thought she could depend on Matt in this. Swan said that man Vanin had rooted out things before she had a chance to put them under his nose, and if she was to come to her senses and run to the band for protection, then the band would have to be close to her. "Shall we go to our horses?" she said. "If we leave now, we should catch up to Lord Brynwell before sunset."
Chapter 45. A Bitter Thought.
As Vilnar led his mounted patrol through the streets of the new city, not far from the tall outer city wall, its gray stone streaked with silver and white in the midday sun, he thought about shaving his beard. Some others already had shaved, even if everyone said the heat was unnatural. It must be cooler back in Saldaea. Letting his thoughts roam was safe enough. He could guide his horse in his sleep, and only the most foolhardy cutpurse would ply his trade anywhere near 10 Saldaeans.
They wrote about at random so the fellows would not know where they were safe. In truth, more often than having to catch thieves, they merely arrested those who came to them. The toughest bully boy in Camelin would come running for Saldaeans to take him up before the Aiel could. So Vilnar kept half an eye on the street and let his mind drift. He thought about the girl back home in Mehar he would like to marry. Terriane's father was a merchant and wanted a soldier for a son, perhaps more than Terriane wanted one for a husband. He thought about the game those Aiel women had suggested. Maiden's kiss sounded innocent enough, but there had been a gleam in their eyes he did not quite trust. Most of all, though, he thought about Aes Sedai. Vilnar had always wanted to see an Aes Sedai, and certainly there could be no better place than Camelin now, unless he went to Tarvalin one day. Apparently, there were Aes Sedai all over Camelin. He had ridden to Culain's Hound, where rumor had 100, but at the last moment he could not make himself go in. He was brave enough with a sword in his hand and a horse between his knees and men or trollocs in front of him, but the thought of Aes Sedai turned him shy. Besides, the inn would not have accommodated 100 women, and none of the girls he saw could possibly be Aes Sedai. He had gone to the Crown of Roses, too, and watched from across the street, but he was not sure any of the women he had seen was Aes Sedai, and that made him sure they were not. He cocked an eye at a thin woman with a wide nose coming out of a tall house that must belong to a merchant. She stood frowning at the street before finally donning a wide-brimmed straw hat and hurrying off. Vilnar shook his head. He could not have said how old she was, but that was not enough. He knew how to recognize an Aes Sedai. Let Jiddar claim they were so beautiful they could kill a man by smiling, and let Rissen insist they were all a foot taller than any man. Vilnar knew it was the face you could tell by, the timeless face of an immortal. It must be impossible to mistake that. As the patrol came opposite the towered vaulting arch of the White Bridge Gate, Vilnar forgot about Aes Sedai. Outside, one of the farmers' markets stretched alongside the road, long open stone sheds, roofed in red or purple tiles, pens full of calves and pigs and sheep, chickens and ducks and geese, stalls selling everything from beans to turnips. Usually those markets were a cacophony of farmers crying their wares, but now, except for the clamor of the animals, silence marched along the market toward the gate, beside one of the oddest processions Vilnar had ever seen. A long column of farmers, four abreast, on horseback, made the bulk of it, and there seemed to be wagons behind. Farmers for sure in those rough coats, but every one of them in Vilnar's sight had the longest bow he had ever seen slung across his back, a full quiver at one hip and a long knife or short sword at the other. Leading the procession was a white banner bordered in red with a red wolf's head, and a mix of people as odd as the column. There were three Aiel, afoot, of course, two of them maidens, and a fellow whose bright green-striped coat and virulent yellow breeches said he was a tinker, except he had a sword on his back. He was leading a horse as big as a Nashun draft horse, with a saddle meant for a giant. The leader seemed to be a heavy-shouldered, shaggy-haired fellow with a short beard and a wicked axe on his belt, and at his side rode a Saldaean woman in dark, narrow, divided skirts who kept looking up at him with the fondest... Vilnar sat forward in his saddle. He recognized that woman. He thought of Lord Bashir in the royal palace right that moment. More, he thought of Lady Deera, and his heart sank. She was in the palace, too. If some Aes Sedai had waved her hand and turned that column into trollocs, Vilnar would have been overjoyed. Maybe this was the price for daydreaming. Had he kept his mind on his duty, the patrol would have been long past here by now. Still, he had his orders. Wondering whether Lady Deera would have his head for a ball, he deployed his men in the gate. Perrin let his dun stallion walk within 10 paces of the city gate before drawing rein. Stepper was as happy to stop. He did not like the heat. The mounted men blocking the gate were Saldaeans, by those bold noses and tilted eyes. Some wore glossy black beards, some thick mustaches, and some were clean-shaven. Every man save one had a hand on his sword hilt. The air stirred from them, not quite a breeze. There was no fear smell.
Perrin looked at Fail, but she was bent over Swallow's arched neck, intent on fiddling with the black mare's bridle. She smelled faintly of herbal soap and anxiety. They had heard news of Saldaeans in Camelin these last 200 miles and more, led by Fail's father, supposedly. That did not seem to worry Fail, but she was certain her mother would be in Camelin as well. She said that did not worry her either.
"We don't even need the bowman," Aram said quietly, stroking the hilt that stuck up over his shoulder.
His dark eyes seemed eager. He certainly smelled eager.
"There are only 10. You and I could cut through them ourselves."
Gaul had veiled himself, and almost certainly Bane and Chiad had too, on the other side of Fail.
"No archers and no cutting," Perrin said, "and no spears, Gaul."
He did not say anything to Bane or Chiad. They only listened to Fail anyway, who did not appear ready to look up or say a word any time soon. Gaul merely lowered his veil with a shrug. Aram frowned in disappointment. Perrin kept his expression mild as he turned back to the Saldaeans. Yellow-gold eyes made some men nervous.
"My name is Perrin Ebarra. I think Randall Thor will want to see me."
The bearded fellow, who had not touched his sword, gave a small bow from the saddle.
"I am Vilnar Barada, Lord Ebarra. Under-lieutenant, sword sworn to Lord Davrim Bashir."
He said that very loudly. Come to think of it, he had been avoiding looking at Fail. She sighed at mention of her father and scowled at Barada, the more so when he continued to ignore her.
"Lord Bashir's orders," the man went on, adding as an afterthought, "and the Lord Dragon's, are that no noble can enter Camelin with more than 20 armed men or 50 servants."
Aram shifted on his horse. He was even more prickly about Perrin's supposed honor than Fail, which was saying something. But thank the light, he would not unsheathe his sword unless Perrin said to. Perrin spoke over his shoulder.
"Danil, take everybody back to that meadow we passed about 3 miles back, and make camp. If a farmer shows up to complain, give him some gold and smooth him down. Let him know he'll be paid for any damage. Aram, you go with them."
Danil Lewin, a beanpole of a man with a thick mustache that almost hit his mouth, knuckled his forehead despite all the times Perrin had told him a simple "all right" would do, and immediately began giving orders to turn everyone around. Aram stiffened, of course. He never liked being far from Perrin. But he said nothing, equally of course. Sometimes Perrin thought he had acquired a wolfhound in the former tinker. Not good for a man to be that way, but he did not know what to do about it. He expected Fail to say a good deal about sending everyone back. He expected her to bring up what was due his so-called position, and insist on the 20 Barada had mentioned, and as close to the 50 as they could manage as well. But she was leaning out of her saddle to speak in whispers with Bane and Chiad. He made a point of not listening, though he could still make out parts of words. Something about men, sounding amused. Women always seemed either amused or angry when they talked of men. Fail was the reason he had all these people trailing after him, and the banner to boot, though he had not yet figured out exactly how she had done it. There were servants back in the wagons, men and women wearing livery with a wolf's head on the shoulder. Even the Two Rivers folk had not complained. They seemed as proud of it as any of the refugees.
"Does that satisfy?" he asked Barada. "You can escort the rest of us to Rand, if you don't want us running loose."
"I think," Barada's dark eyes darted to Fail and away, "I think that would be best."
As Fail straightened, Bane and Chiad trotted to the line of horsemen and pushed through as if they were not there. The Saldaeans did not even look surprised, but then they must be used to Aiel. All the rumors said Camelin was full of Aiel already.
"I must find my spear brothers," Gaul said abruptly. "May you always find water and shade, Perrin Ebarra."
And away he darted after the women.
Fayil hid an amused smile behind a gray-gloved hand.
Perrin shook his head.
Gaul wanted Chiad to marry him, but by Aiel custom, she had to ask him. And though according to Fayil she was willing to become his lover, she would not give up the spear and marry. He seemed as affronted as a Two Rivers girl would have been in the same circumstance. Bane seemed to be part of it too, somehow. Perrin did not understand how. Fayil professed not to know, if a bit too quickly, and Gaul grew sullen when asked. An odd people. The Saldaeans made a way through the crowds, but Perrin paid little mind to crowds or city. He had seen Camlann once, some of it, and he did not much like cities anymore. Wolves seldom came close to a city. He had not sensed one for 2 days. What he did do was study his wife, with sideways looks, trying not to let her notice. He might as well have stared. She always rode erect, but now she was stiff in her saddle, glaring at Barada's back. The man's shoulders were hunched as if he could feel her eyes. A falcon could not glare as well as Fayil. Perrin expected she was thinking of the same thing as he, though maybe not along the same lines. Her father. She might have a few explanations to make. She had run away, after all, to become a hunter for the Horn. But Perrin was the one who had to face the Lord of Bashir, Tyr, and Sedona and tell the man a blacksmith had married his daughter and heir. It was not something Perrin looked forward to. He did not think he was particularly brave. Doing what you had to do was not bravery. But he had never really thought he might be a coward until now.